musical instruments and my soccer ball than in dolls or pretend kitchen sets. But Francie spent hours with Lucy, her plastic baby doll that came with a cloth diaper and a real bottle. She put Lucy to bed in her cradle, all the while singing lullabies and whispering who knows what into her ear. Lucy had a pink stroller, and on nice days, Francie would take her for walks around the yard. Some days Lucy was better taken care of than we were. Growing up, Francie didn't really have boyfriends. She dated a little, but even in high school, Francie was ready to get serious in a way that boys could sense. It scared them, and after a few dates, they'd stop calling. In college, Francie fared a little better, but even then, her desire to settle down was obvious. It was as if she had marriage material tattooed on her forehead. By then, she was already skilled at taking care of me, and why she wanted more responsibility, more burden, I could not understand. Then she moved to Boston and married Mark. It wasn't that I didn't like Mark. He seemed nice enough, if a bit stuffy and traditional. I'd always hoped Francie would end up with someone more creative and daring, someone who'd push her outside her comfort zone, when her desire to live safely was so strong. But the truth is, no one would have ever measured up, because while I wanted Francie to be happy, a selfish part of me wanted her all to myself. Even as an adult, I wanted to be the center of her world. Then Anna and Autumn came, and in that instant, everything changed. Francie had been living in Boston for 4 or 5 years, and we'd adapted to not seeing each other often, though we still talked on the phone nearly every day. With the arrival of Anna and Autumn, our calls grew less frequent. Francie was nursing, or resting, or giving the girls a bath, or just too tired to talk. As they got older, Francie was at the playground, or going to music class, or a playgroup. When we did manage to squeeze in a few minutes, all she wanted to talk about was the new word that Autumn said, the funny thing that Anna had done, or some new mild concern she'd brought up with the doctor. It was boring to listen to, but that didn't bother me. What was so surprising was that Francie hardly ever seemed worried about me anymore. Every now and then she'd ask how I was feeling or if I was still taking my pills, or about the medication's side effects. But she didn't seem as concerned about the answers to the questions as she once had. She merely seemed to be asking out of habit. I knew that Whit still called her every month or so to check in, but I suspected that even those conversations had become perfunctory and automatic, if Francie even answered the phone. In many ways, it was a good thing. Francie was letting me live my life. She was finally living her own life without the constant obligation of caring for me. I knew if I needed her, she'd always help. But what I didn't know was if she would drop everything and come immediately. She had other responsibilities now. She had other loves. And those new loves usurped ours. It wasn't exactly envy that I felt. It was a separation, like when Francie played with Lucy. I was welcome to join them, but it didn't matter to her if I did or not. She would have fun playing without me. I was always invited, but I wasn't necessary to their game. Francie. "I'm here to see a patient," I told the woman at the front desk of the hospital. "Name, please?" "Lottie, Charlotte, Weaver," I corrected myself. Our mother had such high hopes when she named us, Charlotte and Francine Weaver, proper-sounding Bostonian names, even though we were born in California. We were only on the West Coast, temporarily, Mother always said, although that turned out not to be the case. Our parents moved to Palo Alto the year before Lottie and I were born, when our father accepted a job at Stanford. He was a cancer researcher, one of the top in his field, and though Mother admired his work, the move was difficult for her. How could she complain about living so far from her own home when the work her husband did had the potential to save so many lives? She didn't, but she raised us with the belief that we would move back east someday soon. By the time I was in middle school, I no longer believed we'd ever leave California, but Mother never gave up, so the roots she put down in California were tenuous, only reaching a few inches into the ground. Charlotte and Francine. Strong, proud, formal names. Francine became Francie almost immediately, and I have stayed Francie for my whole life. To Mother's dismay, Charlotte was Lottie throughout high school. In college, she became Charlotte again, though by then Mother was gone and not there to appreciate the conversation. And with Charlotte's given name came other far more drastic transformations. "She's in room 308, the woman said. I took the elevator to the third floor, holding Mia's carrier carefully, the heavy bucket seat swinging as I struggled down the hall to Lottie's room. I entered the room so slowly that my sister was revealed to me in pieces. First, I could make out the slight shape of her body under the hospital blanket. She was propped up in the bed, and her right arm was in a bright white cast that rested awkwardly against her body. The left side of her face was pale, her skin nearly as pallid as the sheets, but the right side bloomed a florid red and purple, a dark and swollen wound that took up nearly half her face. Her eyes were open, but they looked sunken and hollow, her cheekbones protruding too sharply. We both heard my quick intake of breath. She stared vacantly at the wall, but when she saw me, she tried to smile. Her eyes were red and moist. "You're here." Lottie's voice was hoarse and raw. I hurried to the bed and settled beside her, placing the baby carrier on the ground. She reached for me with her one good arm, and I held her in an awkward embrace. "Oh, Lottie, are you okay?" "I'm fine, though I know it looks bad," she murmured into my hair, pulling away and catching sight of the baby carrier on the floor. "Mia," she breathed, her eyes filled with tears. I gently took Mia out of the carrier, laying her on the bed between us. I found Lottie's hand. Our heads touched. "You have a baby," I whispered. Lottie nodded, resting her hand on Mia's cheek. "I should have been here," I said. I'd begun to cry, my fear finally cracking with relief at the sight of Lottie alive. Even though she'd told me she was okay, I didn't really believe it till I saw her with my own eyes. "It's okay, Francie." Lottie squeezed my hand lightly.
"I didn't realize you were all alone. I didn't know you and Whit had broken up. I didn't know you had no one to help you. I should have been here."
My cries became harder, turning into full-blown sobs, the kind of uncontrolled, hiccupy crying that I did so rarely, only when I was alone or in front of Lottie.
"Francie, it's okay. Really. I understand now."
Lottie caught my gaze and held it. I forced myself to look at her swollen face.
"You do?"
She looked down at Mia.
"I do. Now I understand."
Mia began to whimper, and Lottie reached for her with her good arm. I carefully placed Mia against her chest.
"I think she's hungry,"
I said, pulling out a bottle and positioning Mia on a pillow in a way that Lottie could feed her.
"What happened?"
I asked after they were settled.
Lottie rolled her eyes. Fucking asshole driver. I was in the bike lane during rush hour. The bastard pulled right out without even looking or signaling. She didn't meet my eyes as she told the story, instead gesturing with her good hand. I waited a moment. The words were stuck in my throat like a chicken bone, sharp and dry. Were you wearing a helmet? Lottie and I had argued about this before. She preferred to ride around town without one, while I thought anyone who would risk the city traffic without a helmet had a death wish. I always knew depression was creeping in when she'd accidentally leave it behind, and though she never said so, I suspected she was testing fate on those days, leaving her life in the hands of unknown forces. I forgot it. She shrugged on one side. I was already late, and I was down the block before I realized I wasn't wearing it. It was stupid. She tried to smile, though she winced and brought her hand to touch her swollen cheek. How terrible do I look? I grimaced. Not great. I looked away and down at Mia. She was falling asleep as she drank the bottle, her eyelids getting heavier and heavier, then fluttering open for a moment before closing again. You just forgot the helmet? I asked quietly. Francie, of course I forgot. It was an accident, Lottie said, and her tone was full of exasperation. But I knew what a good actor my sister could be. Do you have any idea how many biking accidents there are in this city every year? I should have gone back for my helmet, but the driver should have been looking where he was going. I should sue him. I remembered the rotting fruit and the dizzy flies. Your apartment was a mess. Well, call in the merrymaids, Lottie said bitterly. We can't all afford a live-in house cleaner, Francie. I don't have a live-in house cleaner. I did pay a woman once a week to come clean for 4 hours. I still felt guilty about this, and my defensiveness briefly took me away from my line of questioning. I mean, your house looked really bad, like you were depressed. For a moment, she looked at me. Her blue eyes held onto mine, and she seemed about to say something, but then she looked down at Mia. Lottie shook her head. It's hard being a single parent. Harder than I realized. Harder than you can imagine. Especially when you also have to work full-time. The last sentence was a direct jab at me, and though only minutes earlier I'd worried she was dead, for a second I wanted to inflict pain on her. I called Whit. I know. She looked away. He came by last night. I needed someone to check on you. Why? Her voice was suddenly full of anger. We broke up months ago. He's never even met Mia. He wanted nothing to do with her. Is he her father? Part of me still wanted to believe the sperm donor was just a story Lottie had made up. No, she said. He made it very clear that he didn't want any children with me. I went to a sperm bank. Mia's father is a 28-year-old Caucasian non-smoker with no history of mental illness, heart disease, or cancer. That's all I know about him. She looked down at Mia, who was sucking hungrily at the bottle. Whit has nothing to do with us. There's no reason for him to get involved now. I'm sorry. I didn't know who else to call. To help you fix me? There was an ugly sneer on her face. She looked like some sort of ghoul with her awful bruises and dark under-eye circles. They'd shaved away a patch of hair just above her ear, and a thin track of stitches ran several inches. I just thought he should know. I'm sorry. Lottie closed her eyes for a moment, and when she opened them, the anger was gone, replaced with a dim fatigue. She shook her head. I just need you to take care of Mia for me, okay, Francie? Of course I will. I'll stay for as long as you need me. Do you know when you'll be out of the hospital? I asked. Apparently, it's not as serious as it looks. I have a concussion and a broken arm and a fractured ankle. Cuts, bruises, and stitches here and there. Knowing healthcare in this country, they'll probably kick me out today. She rubbed her eyes. Though the doctor said they want to monitor me for internal bleeding, so maybe not for another day or two. What about your meds? Don't worry, the docs have it covered. I looked at her closely, trying to gauge her levels. Relax, Francie. I'm in a hospital. Is there any safer place for a nutcase like me? They're taking care of it. I sighed. It was always like this with Lottie, trying not to ask too much, not to accuse. Mia had finished the bottle and fallen asleep in the crook of Lottie's arm. Are you in a lot of pain? I asked, mostly just to change the subject. She smirked. They've got me so doped up I can barely feel my head. She stifled a yawn. All I want to do is sleep. We'll let you get some rest. I'll call you later, and we'll be by again tomorrow. Okay. Lottie extended her good arm out to me, and I came closer. She clutched my hand. I missed you, Francie. I missed you, too. I moved away so that Lottie could plant a kiss on Mia's cheek and inhale her scent. Tears dripped onto Mia's face, faster than I would have expected. Her fat, round cheek suddenly shiny with water. Lottie sat back and wiped at her eyes. Just take good care of her, okay? She looked drained and tired, sapped of the fight that had been in her just a few minutes ago. I will. You know I will. Lottie fell back against the sheets and closed her eyes, releasing a heavy sigh like air being let out of a balloon. Before Mia was back in her carrier, Lottie had fallen asleep. Or maybe she just didn't want to look at the two of us together anymore. Me, clear-minded and healthy, holding her near-orphaned daughter tightly in my arms. Lottie. I started to fall apart in December. Mia had been with me for 3 months by then. A miraculous and challenging 3 months where I fumbled through everything from daycare to midnight feedings to breast pumps. I was a mother. This reality shocked me every day. I'd been dutifully taking my medication, each morning swallowing down my handful of brightly colored pills. But they weren't working. At least not the way they were supposed to. When Mia was born, I'd switched to a different combination, one that allowed me to breastfeed her. But the pills weren't right, and I was still experiencing symptoms. Not the full-blown black or white, but glimmers of each. Before the hospital released Mia and me, the obstetrician, knowing my history, made me set up an appointment with a psychiatrist to monitor the new concoction of medication. The psychiatrist had tinkered with the dosage and sent me on my way, booking me for another appointment in 2 weeks to see how things were. 2 weeks later, I was still wobbly, depression creeping in around the edges in the dark hours of the silent house when it was only me and Mia. But the night before the follow-up appointment, Mia was up 5 times in 7 hours. I turned the alarm off in the morning before I could wake her again, and I overslept, missing the appointment. Between getting ready to go back to work and trying to adjust to my new life, I hadn't rescheduled. My maternity leave would run out after the winter break, and I was both dreading going back to work and dying to return. I knew the isolation of being alone with Mia all day wasn't good for me, but I wasn't sure how I would manage to juggle both the job and Mia. It wasn't only the hours of teaching. It was the pile of papers that I came home with and corrected each week, staying up late into the night with a stack of essays, then sleeping late the next morning since my first classes rarely started before 11. When she wasn't waking me to feed, Mia mewed like a kitten until I held her. I didn't know how I'd ever keep on top of my classes and her needs. Sleep deprivation, difficult for all new mothers, was even more dangerous for me. It was nearly Christmas, and I'd promised myself and Mia we'd get a tree.
Not that a 3-month-old cared about a Christmas tree, but it seemed symbolic somehow. A promise that I could raise her on my own and fill our life together with happy memories. Though still functioning, I had the high-flying transcendence that often preceded the full-blown white. Yet instead of rescheduling an appointment with the doctor, I drove to a Christmas tree lot and picked out the tallest, fattest tree there. The man at the lot helped me tie the tree to the roof of the car. When we pulled up in front of our house, I got out of the car and stood, staring at the enormous tree strapped to the roof. It hadn't occurred to me how I would get it up the stairs of my house and inside, all the while struggling to get Mia and her diaper bag inside as well. What an inane ritual, I thought. To chop down a perfectly healthy, growing tree and bring it into a house for a few weeks, only to decorate it with plastic crap and feed it tiny sips of water until it withered away before your eyes. 3 weeks from now, the streets would be littered with dead trees, their green carcasses lining the sidewalks, waiting for the garbage truck. And here I was, participating in this disgusting tradition, teaching Mia that it was okay to treat living things like disposable commodities. I drove back to the lot. Getting out of the car, I smelled the rich scent of evergreen trees in the cool night air. Frosty the Snowman was playing over the speakers, and the lot was lit with strings of colored lights. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I recognized a hint of nostalgia. I vaguely remembered a morning when Francie and I sat cross-legged under a tree and unwrapped matching pink bathrobes with furry high-heeled slippers. The living room smelled of pine needles and the orange poked with cloves that Mother put out at Christmas. We'd put on the bathrobes immediately, dancing through the living room while Mother and Daddy watched us, Mother sipping her coffee, a small smile on her face as she watched us dance. It was a good memory. Though like all memories of my mother, it was always laced with something else. So I pushed it aside and found the man who'd sold us the tree. He was young, in his early 20s, perhaps a student at the university, maybe even someone who'd taken a class with me. He wore a Cal baseball cap and protective gloves to keep his hands from getting stabbed by the sharp needles. "Hey, you're back again. You need another tree?" He gave us an easy grin. "No, I want to return this one." I gestured to my car parked in the lot. Mia was strapped to my chest in her baby Bjorn. "You want to exchange it for a different one?" "No, I want to return it." He frowned. "Is something wrong with the tree? Is it damaged?" "It's dead," I told him. He let out a short laugh. "Well, yeah. I mean, they sell live ones that you can take home to plant, but we don't sell those here." He looked at me closely. He had green eyes and a beautiful mouth. I wondered briefly if I could take him home with me. "It's wrong. It's a disgusting practice that should be outlawed." Mia rested her head against my chest. It was well past her bedtime. "What a thing to expose a child to." The man shrugged. "I just work here. I didn't chop the tree down. I didn't create the tradition of Christmas trees. I didn't make you buy a tree. I just work here." "You should be ashamed of yourself," I said. He rolled his eyes. Even in the dim light, I could see that they were framed by long lashes. "Do you want the tree or not? We don't usually take returns, but since you bought it just a few minutes ago, I'll take it back if you don't want it."
"We don't want it."
"Okay." He walked toward the car, untying the rope and hauling the tree down. He handed me several 20s. "Here you go."
"I think you should replant it," I told him.
He let out another short laugh.
"I think you should replant them all." "I'll help you," I said earnestly.
"Are you out of your mind? The trees have already been chopped down." He turned away, holding the tree firmly by the middle. I could almost make out the muscles beneath his sweatshirt, and I had a sudden yearning to hold his bicep between my palms. Next year, think about buying one with the roots attached. There are plenty of places in Berkeley where you can get those. Wait. My desire was banging against my indignation. He turned back, and I reached for him, catching the sleeve of his sweatshirt between my fingers. You can come home with me. He looked down at my hand, his expression an odd mix of disbelief and disgust. We'll plant the trees in my yard. I glanced down at Mia and lowered my voice into what I imagined was a smoky whisper. Then you can stay with me. I'll put her to bed. It'll be fun. He was already backing away, his sweatshirt out of my reach. I don't think so. Go home and put your kid to bed. It's almost 10 o'clock. He turned away from me, shaking his head, dragging the dead tree behind him. I stood there watching him and then walked toward the car. I bundled Mia back into her car seat. Her head was heavy with sleep. I felt the weight of my embarrassment and fury, my helplessness and terror. It would only be a matter of time before I directed it all at Mia, and the sudden realization hit me with a frightening clarity. In the bathroom at home, I brushed my teeth. The overhead light cast a greenish tinge on my skin, exposing every wrinkle, pockmark, and blemish. I pictured the look of disgust on the man's face when I offered to bring him home. The shame rose up in my body like a blush, familiar and toxic. I opened the medicine cabinet and found jumbled rows of lotions, oils, prescriptions, and other pills. Behind a bottle of Excedrin, I found what I was looking for, a small box of razor blades. I made sure Mia was asleep before I securely closed the door to my bedroom, the box in my hand. I sat up in bed, my legs pulled into my chest. Slowly, I rolled up the leg of my pajama pants, revealing a flesh-colored bandage on my upper calf. I loosened the tape of the bandage, pushing back the corners with my fingernail until I'd eased off the flap. I peeled back the bandage, revealing 3 neat lines that had crusted into scabs. Rubbing the pad of my thumb along the rust-colored scabs, I felt the thin ridge of dried blood where the wounds were mostly healed. If I left them alone with a daub of antiseptic, they'd be gone within a week or two. I looked around the bedroom before I started, as if someone might have snuck in without me knowing it, as if the worst part about a prowler in the house would be getting caught doing this. But the room was empty and quiet, and so I began the sick habit I'd reacquired in the months since Francie stopped speaking to me. It was a habit I found more embarrassing than disturbing. As a professor, I had girls who did this. Cutters, we called them. The term always conjured up pictures of saw-wielding young women in lumber jackets and plaid flannel shirts cutting wood. In health services offices, I once picked up a glossy pamphlet on the subject. Warning signs, it read in bold black letters. But I could no longer remember if the cutting was a warning sign for something else or if we were supposed to be looking for warning signs of cutting. With the edge of the razor blade, I methodically sliced off the first scab. A thin line of blood rose up immediately. With the blood, I felt my air passages opening more widely, my breath coming more easily. I inhaled deeply as the pain began its slow and pleasant burn, and then I moved on to the second stripe, less hesitant this time. The slicing more controlled. The pamphlet had taken a clinical view on this behavior, but I've always understood the allure. It was like lancing a blister. There is so much hurt below the surface that adding a little more pain actually made the wound feel better. It released the pressure that burned below. I brought the blade down one more time, harder, and the blood came thicker. One more time, one more stripe. I closed my eyes as I finished off the last scab. When I opened them, there were three lines of fresh blood, much like the marks left by a cat's claws, a tattooed kiss to my daughter, the pain taken out on myself instead of her. I replaced the bandage, the calm settling over me. Francie. As we grew into adults, I became Lottie's guardian, but it wasn't always that way. From birth through high school, she shielded me from the world. On Saturday nights in high school, Lottie went out and I stayed in, watching TV well past when our parents had gone to bed. The evening would pass quietly, and during commercials, I'd wonder what Lottie was doing, who she was with. I never joined her and her friends, choosing the solitude of our darkened living room over my own social awkwardness at a party. Just as Saturday Night Live came on, Lottie would make her curfew. We'd watch the first few skits together and then go upstairs to the bedroom that we shared. This was my favorite part of the night. Lottie would usually be breathless and excited from the party she had been to, occasionally a little boozy, but this just made her more talkative. We turned off the bedroom light, talking until we both fell asleep. One particular night has always stuck out sharply in my memory. It was our junior year, the final night of our school's production of Bye Bye Birdie. Lottie was the female lead. I'd attended opening night with our parents, and I was struck silent by how she transformed herself on stage. On the final night of the show, the cast was going to a party at Marty Layton's house. Marty was a senior and the leading man opposite Lottie in the play. He was tall and broad-shouldered, with thick black eyebrows that framed a pair of eyes so blue it was rumored he wore colored contact lenses. Lottie had developed a huge crush on him, and she'd been looking forward to the party even more than the final production of the show. Though our curfew was 11:30, neither of our parents was ever up to enforce it. The night of Marty's party, I watched all of Saturday Night Live by myself and nearly fell asleep on the couch waiting for Lottie to come home. As I watched television, I developed an achy nausea that started in my belly but seemed to spread throughout my body, reaching all the way into my throat and down into the tips of my toes. I blamed it on the popcorn, though I knew better, and eventually went upstairs to get ready for bed. When Lottie finally opened the bedroom door, I'd fallen asleep. The sick feeling hadn't disappeared, but it had settled some and now just hung there, heavy and woolen in my stomach. The bedside clock read 2:22 a.m.
"So, how was it?" I asked through the grogginess of sleep.
"Oh, Francie, you scared me."
Lottie's voice sounded odd and high-pitched.
"What happened with Marty?"
She was making strange sniffing noises and kept her back to me as she undressed. In the dim blue light, she hunched her shoulders and unbuttoned her sleeveless top, letting it fall to the floor. She stepped out of her skirt and sandals and pulled on a t-shirt.
"What happened?" I asked again.
"Nothing."
Lottie peeled back the covers on her bed and climbed in. I reached out and turned on the bedside lamp. Lottie winced at the brightness, bringing her hand up to her mouth, but she wasn't fast enough. Her lower lip was a swollen, purplish red. I brought my hand to my own mouth, my body suddenly throbbing in sympathy as it often did when Lottie was hurt.
"What happened?"
I asked again, getting out of bed and going to her.
"Nothing. I mean, it was an accident."
Lottie tried to smile at me, but the pain in her lip made her cringe instead.
"Do you want to hear about Marty?"
She tried to look excited, but her eyes were dull.
"Yeah, what happened?"
"Get back in bed,"
Lottie ordered, and I obeyed. She turned off the light.
"I did it."
"Did what?"
I did it. I slept with him. Lottie sounded giddy, but her voice verged on the hysterical.
Oh my God, Lottie.
Really? I asked, incredulous.
You really slept with him? What happened?
Well, the show was great. It was a packed house. Our biggest audience all week. And then we went to the party at his house.
Uh-huh.
We just kind of hung around together all night. I had a few drinks, and eventually Marty asked if I wanted to go upstairs, and I said yes. I mean, that's what I wanted to happen all along.
You'd been planning on sleeping with him?
Though I didn't understand either emotion, and I tried to suppress them both, I found myself fighting both envy and sympathy. Well, no, but I wanted something to happen. I just hadn't figured out how much. She was quiet. Okay, I said slowly, my voice urging her to continue. So we went up to his room. It all just happened so fast.
Tell me.
I wasn't planning on sleeping with him, but I could tell he wanted to. I mean, of course he wanted to. He's a guy, Lottie joked, but her voice was false.
What happened to your mouth? Did he do something to you?
No. I mean, not on purpose. We were moving positions a lot, and it was dark in the room. Somehow his head ended up hitting me in the mouth. That's what happened to my lip. And then, I don't know, then we were doing it. And it hurt, but it's supposed to hurt, right? It just hurt more than I thought it would. She was quiet for a moment. And then it was over. We went back down to the party, and Marty got me an ice pack for my lip, which was kind of embarrassing. It had already started to swell, and people kept asking me what happened, and what was I supposed to say? Marty hit me with his head while we were having sex. Lottie tried to laugh. I just told people I'd had too much to drink and tripped. Somehow that sounded better. She was silent, waiting for my reaction.
Oh, Lottie. I didn't know what to say. I wasn't sure if I should congratulate or comfort her. Did you want to sleep with him? The twin beds in our room were only a foot apart. Lottie lay on her side, toward the open window so I couldn't see her face. Her back rose and fell lightly as she breathed.
What? Lottie stalled. Oh, I don't know. I guess so.
Did he make you do it?
No. Then again, more softly, no. It really wasn't like that, Francie. Don't go all after-school special on me, okay? She shifted in her bed, and in the inky darkness, I saw that her eyes were closed. She spoke without opening them. It all happened so fast. We're not even going out. I just figured my first time would be with a boyfriend. I was silent. What was there to say? It's not a big deal, she said brightly. It had to happen sometime. Why not with Marty Layton? I could lose my virginity a lot worse, right? Lottie reached out and held on to my fingers. She squeezed them tightly. Right? She asked again.
Right, I assured her.
Lottie didn't let go of my fingers, not even after we both fell asleep. I woke up later that night, and our fingers were still entwined, both of our hands clammy and warm. I thought about it all the next week, each time I saw Marty in the hallway at school, leaning against the shiny purple lockers and fawning over girls with too much makeup and short skirts. Though Lottie claimed not to care, I knew she was hurt. There was something underhanded in what he'd done. He looked so cocky and confident each time I saw him, thick black brows with furry caterpillars creeping across his face, and those blue eyes that may or may not have come from a box. For her part, Lottie seemed to have moved on, and if nothing else, Marty was discreet. No one at school seemed to have heard about what happened at the party. The only time that I ever got close to confronting him was on the afternoon that our whole world had changed, just a week later. It was a Friday, and I was hurrying to French class. We were having a test on the conditional, and I recited the different forms aloud in my head, the verbs looping through my brain so quickly that I almost didn't see Marty leaning on his locker. He caught sight of me and quickly turned away, and then realizing that I wasn't Lottie, turned back again, relaxing. I hated him in that moment, and I narrowed my eyes at him and squared my shoulders, ready to face him. He didn't give me the chance. Within seconds, he'd slammed his locker shut and yelled ahead to another senior boy in a red and blue varsity jacket. He disappeared into the emptying hallway before I even had a chance to open my mouth. The giant clock in the hallway said that I was 4 minutes late for the exam. As I arrived at French class, still berating myself for my failed efforts to redeem Lottie, I heard the loudspeaker summoning Lottie and me to the office. Already in Madame Loisel's classroom, the other students were bent over the test, furiously trying to remember how to conjugate the irregular verbs that Madame had thrown in just to check if we'd studied. With my hand on the door, peering through the glass, I was grateful that I'd been given a reprieve from the test, even if only for a few extra minutes. I would always feel bad about being relieved, as if I might have been able to change something had I intuited the danger more quickly. Lottie was already in the principal's office, sitting anxiously in one of Mr. Lombeck's comfortable chairs. I hadn't seen my sister since that morning when we parted ways in the hall. Lottie's hands were busy in her lap, twisting and untwisting together, and it was the nervousness in her fidgeting that gave me my first flutter of anxiety. Mr. Lombeck looked up from his desk and motioned me into the room. I took the seat beside Lottie. We didn't speak, but Lottie reached out and grasped my hand, squeezing it tightly. I looked from her to Mr. Lombeck in confusion. Already, Lottie's eyes were wet.
"There's been an accident," Mr. Lombeck said, breaking the silence.
"What kind of accident?" I asked.
"Mother,"
Lottie whispered. "Is she okay?" I directed the question at Mr. Lombeck, not Lottie. He was the adult. He would reassure us.
"Your father's on his way."
Mr. Lombeck didn't look at either of us and instead stared down at the pile of paperwork on his desk, a pen poised in his hand. He never wrote anything, just stared blankly at the page. His office wasn't particularly hot, but I noticed his brow perspiring, and every few minutes he wiped his forehead with the back of his hand. Later, we speculated whether Mr. Lombeck knew that she was dead. Lottie didn't think he knew anything more than that there'd been an accident, but I maintained that he knew all along and didn't want to be the one to have to tell us. I held those long minutes of not knowing against him through the rest of high school, even after he wrote me a college recommendation. Our father arrived soon after. He looked oily and ragged, his graying brown hair sticking up in funny little tufts around his head, his checked shirt coming untucked from his pants. Mr. Lombeck got up quickly then, leaving us alone in the office. When I heard accident, I'd immediately assumed a car accident. What other kind of serious accident did people have? But what our father told us, as he got down on his knees and grasped our hands as if we were small children, as if we were in a church rather than our principal's office, was that it was not that kind of accident. In a bone-weary voice, our father told us that Mother had fallen. The stairs in our house were steep and narrow, and when we were little, Mother frequently told us to slow down, warning that someone was going to break her neck on those stairs if she kept running up and down at such outrageous speeds. And that's exactly what happened. As Mother carried a basket of laundry downstairs, the sheets and pillowcases and towels blocking her view,
She slipped and fell down those steep stairs. She landed at the bottom, dirty laundry scattered on the floor, her neck snapped cleanly in half. Lottie. Our mother was beautiful. She was slender, with long black hair that fell in waves down her back, and she had excellent posture. Before Francie and I were born, she was a dancer, a ballerina in a small company in Boston. The story we'd been told many times by our father was that one night he was dragged to a dance performance, a benefit for the university in Boston where he was working. Our mother was one of the ballerinas on stage in a pale pink tulle skirt and white tights, her hair pulled into a shiny black bun. Our father sat in his seat, mesmerized by the leaps and pirouettes mother performed across the stage. He watched, nearly breathless, through the entire performance, trying to figure out how to talk to her after the show. When it was over, he made excuses to his colleagues and hung around the lobby near the dressing room where the ballerinas were changing. Finally, Mother emerged. She'd taken off her costume and wore a cotton skirt and wool sweater, her long black hair unpinned in loose waves around her face. He told her how much he loved the performance, how beautiful she was on the stage. They talked for a long time in the lobby of the theater, and then he walked her home. On the way out, he hunched in the doorway and lit Mother's cigarette for her. That was how he knew he was done for. Our father, the cancer researcher, lit the cigarette of the woman he'd already fallen in love with. He followed the burning ember all the way back to Mother's apartment. That was the story our father told us while we were growing up, and Mother smiled patiently when he told it, rolling her eyes every now and then. In each telling, there was a new embellishment. Some tiny detail was different. The color of Mother's skirt was sometimes gray and sometimes purple. Her hair was down, or other times it was held to the side with a butterfly barrette. In one version, he walked her back to her apartment and kissed her goodnight. In another, they stopped at an Italian restaurant and shared a plate of spaghetti and meatballs. In yet another version, she invited him upstairs and made them both grilled cheese sandwiches and tomato soup. Francie and I loved each story, and we'd press him for more. We were never concerned that the story always changed. In my mind, they fell in love in all the versions our father had created. Not until high school did Mother tell me the truth. It was a Thursday evening, and I'd just gotten home from soccer practice. Our father was still at work and most likely would be for another few hours. Francie was upstairs doing homework. Mother sat at the table with me while I wolfed down the plate of macaroni and cheese she'd kept warm on the stove. She sipped a glass of white wine and smoked a cigarette while I ate, turning her head to blow the smoke away from my meal. I could tell she was sad. Unlike Francie, I was better able to read our mother's moods and sense when a change was coming. Yet I was also still naive enough to think we might be able to control the course her moods would take. I tried to engage her in the story of meeting our father, prompting her to tell it. She was never the one to tell the story. It was always our father. She let out a thin sigh and looked just past me without answering. I urged her on. What was the performance that you were in? Did you see Daddy in the audience? Could you tell that he was watching you? I pressed. The cigarette burned between her fingers, untouched for several moments. She seemed deep in thought, as if she were trying to remember. When she spoke, she didn't answer my questions. I realized later she was debating whether she should tell me at all.
That's not how it happened, Charlotte.
Your father and I met at the party of a mutual friend. He didn't even see me dance until we'd already been dating for several months. She raised her eyebrows and waved the hand that held the cigarette in the air. Your father prefers his story. It's more romantic. After a moment, she stood and began tidying the kitchen. I sat heavily at the table, the half-eaten bowl of macaroni still in front of me, holding up to the light Mother's story against the many versions I'd heard over the years. At the time, I'd felt a sadness over the mundane and simple truth. It wasn't until years later that I wondered if perhaps our father's was the truer one after all. My mother taught me that every story has 100 versions. Within each one exists 100 lies. The trick is to find the kernel of truth tucked into the center. If you can find that, cup your hands gently around it. Don't touch it, because it can burn you. Just know it's there. Keep that secret knowledge to yourself and follow it home, like a glowing ember in the quickly darkening night. Francie. Saturday morning, Mia woke at 6. I stumbled into the kitchen to make a bottle and then brought her back to bed with me. After sucking down the milk, she dozed for another hour. Instead of sleeping, I watched her. The healthy pink cheeks, the bow of a mouth, the thick dark hair. Lottie may have been struggling to hold her life together, but Mia was perfect. I put Mia in the infant seat on the floor and made coffee, sitting down at one of the tall stools as I tried to figure out what came next. Sometime soon I would visit my father in the nursing home in Palo Alto. The thought of visiting him left me with an anxious dread, as each time his decline was more dramatic. He'd been diagnosed with Alzheimer's 4 years earlier, and though I called him every week, most times he didn't know who I was. We'd had more than one conversation that ended with him putting the phone down and wandering off while I kept talking. I pushed the thought of him aside for the moment. There were too many other things to worry about. From the living room, my cell phone rang. I knew it would be Mark before I even looked at the display. But when I answered, it was the girls, their voices nearly identical as they prattled away about the movie Daddy had rented for them and the pizza they ordered for dinner with just pepperoni, no vegetables, exactly the way they liked it, and when was I coming home? "Mommy, when are you coming home?" Their voices pulled me back, an invisible cord stretching across the miles between us, and I ached with missing them. Mark got on a few minutes later, and I brought the phone into the kitchen and sat on the floor beside Mia.
"How are you?"
he asked. I felt my daughter's absence deep in my throat. I held Mia's chubby hand in my own, fingering the baby smoothness of her palm.
"I'm okay."
It was nearly 10 o'clock in Boston. I pictured him sitting in the kitchen with his own mug of coffee, with cream and 2 sugars in his favorite Red Sox mug. "Are the girls all right?"
"They're fine. They miss you and want to know when you're coming home."
He paused.
"How's your sister?"
"She's fine. Well, not fine, but she's going to be okay." I handed Mia a set of plastic keys from the counter, which she began to chew on. "She has a broken arm, so she's going to be in a cast for a while, and she might have one on her foot, too. It's a miracle she's alive." She wasn't wearing a helmet. This still nagged at me, despite Lottie's protestations.
"Why not? Goddamn bikers think they're untouchable."
Mark frequently came home with complaints about the bike messengers downtown who zoomed in and out of traffic, ignoring all road rules. "Mark!" Though I felt the same frustration, I didn't like his criticism of Lottie.
"So, what's your plan?"
His words were tentative, waiting for me to snap at him. "My plan?" I forced myself not to sound exasperated. "I don't really have one right now. I'm just taking this day by day." I hated the cautious way we spoke to each other, both of us trying not to start a fight, both of us always hovering around the edge of one. I wasn't quite sure what it was that had come between us over the last year or so. Somewhere around the time that the girls entered kindergarten, things had changed. Since then, my days had taken on a tedious routine. I went through the motions of being a good wife and mother. School drop-off, grocery shopping, dinner preparation, dealing with endless piles of laundry. But I was detached from each task. There was both so much and so little to do, and I'd be surprised when it was time to pick up the girls, yet amazed by how little I'd actually done all day. Lottie would have said I was depressed, and maybe I was, but not in the throes of blackness that she experienced. I knew deep down that part of my malaise was because I was empty without her. Without Lottie, I didn't have anyone to confide in about how I was feeling. Instead, I tried to talk with my friend, Beth. Recently, she'd gone back to work full-time, and I missed the long morning coffees we used to share after dropping the kids at preschool. We still talked on the phone a few times a week. It was during one of these conversations that I told her I'd been feeling restless and that Mark and I weren't connecting lately. It was a Tuesday, and Beth was home with Elijah, who had the flu. The phone was tucked under my ear as I folded laundry. "I'm telling you, Francie, you're fucking miserable and just don't even realize it," Beth said. "How do you know?" I asked, both insulted and intrigued at how Beth could peer inside of me and be able to spot something so easily. "Because it was the same way with me. I didn't realize how unhappy I was until I got back to work. I'm telling you, going back was the best thing I could have done. For Elijah, for my marriage, but most importantly, for me."
"You weren't miserable. I used to see you every day. I would have known if you'd been miserable."
"Francie, I was a fucking mess. You didn't always see it, but at least 2 days a week, I would go home and cry my eyes out while Elijah was napping. Never in front of him, or you, or Thomas, because God forbid I actually tell my husband how fucking unhappy I was. But at least 2 days a week, I would go home and cry."
I was stunned. I couldn't imagine it. "Well, maybe you should see someone," I suggested. "That sounds pretty serious."
"I did see someone. I saw a shrink who told me that I didn't need antidepressants. She said I had too much time to think, and it was making me unhappy."
"Too much time? I don't have any time," I argued. I could barely form a complete thought without being interrupted by one of the girls or by some unfinished chore. Crumbs that needed sweeping or a meal that needed to be prepared.
"Too much time to think," she clarified. "You need to get out of your own head." Her prescription was to go back to work.
I imagined the therapist scribbling the word employment on a prescription pad. "That's ridiculous," I said, because it was easier than sifting through the emotions brought up by this advice.
"Maybe, but since I've gone back to work, I haven't cried once. Well, once, when I watched this terrible movie on TV about a mother who is dying, but you know what I mean."
"Well, that's you, Beth. I'm not coming home and crying every day," I said, which was true. "When it's time to go back, I'll know."
"But you won't, Francie. That's my point. I didn't know. I was crying like a baby, but I didn't know until I actually paid a woman to tell me what the hell was wrong with me. I could have gone on like that for another 3 years. Carpooling and doing laundry and wiping snotty noses."
"But you still have to do all of those things," I said, carrying a stack of clothes into the girls' bedroom. "It's not like by working you get out of all that."
"No, but it's about having something else in my life that doesn't revolve around taking care of other people."
I didn't say anything. Instead, I smoothed out a green corduroy jumper of Anna's, rubbing the wrinkles with my thumb.
"Francie, are you there?" Beth asked.
"I'm here."
"Oh, Jesus, I'm an asshole. Listen to me. Back at work for barely 3 months and acting as if I've discovered the answer to life.
No, it's fine, I said.
Hun, if you're happy being home, don't even listen to me. Some women are